Well, thank you for coming. This is a teach-in on the current financial crisis in the University of California, San Francisco, which is part of the crisis affecting the university as a whole and in turn affecting the state of California. This teach-in is sponsored by the Faculty Association here on campus. My name is Warren Gold. I'm a professor of medicine here and also chair of the Faculty Association. The plan for today, this afternoon, is to have the four speakers present each of their talks and then have the Q&A to follow. I think this computer is frozen again.
Try hitting page now or this week.
So the first speaker is going to represent the student opinion, and Annika Klein, who's president of the Graduate Student Association at UCSF, will speak. As a future alumna on the future of the university, then Stan Glantz will talk about UC's budget mess, how we got here, how little it would cost to get out. Robert Meister from Santa Cruz will talk on who pays and who benefits, higher education and taxation as engines of equality and growth. And George Ruff from UC Berkeley, his talk will be on privatization and democracy, how we can change our future. So after the four speakers talk, we'll have a Q&A period. Let's start out with Anna Klein, a future alumna on the future of the university. I will moderate this discussion, and I will pull you away from the microphone if you go over your allotted time. I guarantee it.
Hi. So my name is Annika Klein. I was asked to speak here today because I made remarks to the UC Commission on the Future about the student voice regarding the future of the university. I'm an MD and PhD student here at UC San Francisco, and in addition to being both a professional and academic graduate student, I've also taken an active role in student government, both internally on campus and externally. I've attended numerous Regents meetings, met with various staff members in the UC Office of the President, and spoken with members of both the state and federal legislature on behalf of students within the entire University of California. So, a future alumni and the future of the UC. When looking to the future, we must first look to the past. Every year, with one exception, since I have been here, a student here at UCSF, the fees have increased. And each year, students come together to lobby the UC Regents to indicate their dissatisfaction with the fee increases. Every year, students hear the same response to our concerns, that the legislature has left the university with no choice. However, when we, these same students, react appropriately by going to speak with our respective representatives in Sacramento, there is rarely a single UC Regent or campus chancellor with us on the steps of the Capitol echoing our message that the state needs to prioritize education in order to keep the economy strong. Embarrassingly, actually, one year after students went to Sacramento to lobby on fees, the next day the Office of the President came to the Capitol with only the message that UC is going green. This mixed messaging has led most of the state to believe that the UC is a top education at a good value. In the publicly available UCOP budget documents, one will find that the fee comparisons between the UC and other institutions include only the education fee. Many of you may not know about the fee structure here, but this document for the public fails to compare the real cost of attendance of the UC, which includes other fees, the registration fee, other campus-based fees, facilities fees, health insurance fees, let alone the cost of living. It cannot be surprising that if the people of the state are under the belief that the UC is a bargain, that the legislature of the state reflects this belief. Even after the economic recession improves, how can we expect to curb the cuts in state funding if we are not willing to stand up and acknowledge that the university is losing quality and affordability simultaneously? The biggest question regarding the University of California in the future is how do we maintain a quality and affordable education with less available state funding? Any solution, I believe, needs to bear in mind the following 3 points. First, students need a predictable fee schedule. Imagine that you were to buy an all-inclusive vacation only to arrive at your destination and discover that you, in fact, needed to pay extra for meals, for linens, for transportation, and that the extra fees you had to pay were not only unexpected, but also increased in amount daily. How likely would you be to rate that vacation company highly? Similarly, imagine you're a UC student, soon to graduate from your education and to embark on your career, like me. The unpredictable nature of these fee increases alienates many potential alumni donors. No matter what the UC system chooses to do with fees in the future and the future of the UC in general, students have the right to plan their finances ahead for 4 years of their enrollment. This is not an issue of a disgruntled freshman. This is an issue of alienating a long-term revenue source for the university. The second point is that students need to see increases in quality when fees increase. While students can sympathize with one of the worst budgetary years in the past decade or more, we are also very alarmed to see any faculty or graduate student support cut. At the heart of the quality of this university are the faculty members that oversee research and the graduate students who carry out those projects. While it is true that the other operations and staff within the university have also accepted furloughs and salary reductions, the university needs to better protect the parts of the machine that drive innovation. Along the same veins, it is possible to generate more revenue for this university from the intellectual property that we generate. Unfortunately, of the patent applications submitted here at UCSF, the Office of Technology Management, perhaps only 10% are filed. For the unlucky inventor for which this university has declined to assist in patent filing, he or she is forced to find the $15,000 on his or her own. These inventors are young faculty and do not have the money or time to complete this task. It's a lose-lose situation, the university losing out on a potential revenue source and the inventor unable to bring their idea to market and grow the economy of the state. There are many ways to free up money for the university that do not meet student fee increases, some of which are already in the works. For example, the UC Regents are likely to approve a single health insurance plan for graduate students, all graduate students, starting potentially in the fall of 2010, somewhat mitigating the damage of the education and registration fee increases. So the last point, 3, students need a diverse educational environment to prepare them to serve the entirety of the university of the state, of California. By maintaining high quality research, the UC has brought and will continue to bring revenue from corporate innovation to the state. However, there's also a need to educate students who are interested in serving communities where the rate of new business growth is not yet the economic driver. Because the residents of these communities have paid taxes, they deserve the fruits of their investment in education like anyone else in the state. The real danger of privatization of this university is that private institutions do not have as inherent part of their mission the need to serve the state of California. I, for one, chose to attend UCSF, a public school within California, over many enticing offers at other institutions, private institutions, not just because of its high-quality research reputation here, but also because I share a desire to give back to the people who have invested in my education. Unfortunately, for many of my professional school classmates who share this vision, as fees increase more than 33% year after year, we cannot afford to serve the needy communities where our income will not support our personal loan deficit. I ask, where else would you have us go to get trained in how to best serve these communities? Looking ahead, we must create funded tracks within the UC specifically to prepare our graduates for working with underserved and socioeconomically disadvantaged populations. To best protect the University of California means improving the economy of the state as a whole, not just by assisting the most wealthy and privileged. I remind you that an average can be increased by not only protecting and growing at the top, but also improving at the bottom. You may ask why students at UCSF are not just concerned with the now. Why do we care about the future of the school after we graduate from it? Because we are graduate and professional students, and thus older than undergraduates. We often settle in the Bay Area, start our families here, and continue relationships with both UCSF and the surrounding community. If we cannot afford to live in the Bay after our education because of inflated loan repayments, then we will start choosing other schools and serving other communities. Unlike many undergraduates, professional and graduate students at UCSF see it as part of our mission to develop and educate the classmates we have in the years below us. student-student mentorship and guidance is a critical feature of this university that often goes unlooked. It takes only a year or two of a new student mentality to destroy this important part of a pipeline spanning as much as 15 years. For example, for medical students who become residents, who become fellows, who become faculty. We see that our relationship with the UC does not end the day we graduate, and that the experiences of the students that come after us can have a dramatic impact on our future. This is why the alarming increases in fees, the lack of faculty support, and other declines in quality that occur today are so very damaging. They can destroy the quality of a UC in a way that it may never recover. So finally, the student message on the future of the UC is very clear. We are worried that our efforts, our years of studying, and our money will be wasted. We are worried that a bankrupted UC will lose its reputation as the best public school in the country, in the same way the K-12 system in California has. We are worried that this loss will lead the state legislature to further neglect the UC in its annual budget. We are worried this will logically lead to fee increases. We are worried the defeated reputation and high cost will cause the essential parts of our high-quality university, the graduate students and postdocs in labs, the faculty, the professional students, especially those from underserved communities who are most invested in improving the places in which they grew up, to vacate the university, further hurting the reputation of the school and completing a spiral from which the UC will never recover. But more than this spiral of decreasing quality and increasing fees, we are more concerned with a school that is private and loses its connection with the taxpayers and communities that invested in it, that no longer incentivizes the innovators raised in California to stay and contribute to the economy here. We'd like to see this University of California continue to be from, of, and for the state of California. Thank you.
You want to say something?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, the next speaker is Stan Glantz. His topic is UC's budget mess, how we got here, and how little it would cost to get us out.
Stan. So, thank you. Just for those few of you who are here who don't know what my qualifications of this are, I was one of the four faculty. One, two, three. Who is the fourth one? I can't remember. Yes. Who said the UC-Stanford merger was a stupid idea before it happened. And that's how we became experts in the budget. And that led me to be put on the Committee on Planning and Budget for UCSF, and then system-wide, and I chaired the Committee on Planning and Budget, I guess, 4 years ago. And I want to second everything you said except for one thing, and that is the legislature. The legislature is not the problem. The legislature is almost irrelevant. The real power and the real issue about the budget is the governor. And the prime directive the Office of the President is do whatever it takes to keep the governor happy and then blame the legislature. So when I was growing up, I don't know what I'm sure there's an equivalent today, but Bozo the Clown was very popular with kids a long time ago. And I remember having this blow-up Bozo doll that was like this high, that had a weight in the bottom, and you could punch it and it would flop down and then pop up again. And that's the legislature in terms of this debate, and for that matter the regents too, because they don't have any power either. They're dealing with the money that they get. And the reason that the prime derivative at OP is to keep the governor happy is that the governor has a line item veto in California, and so even if they can get the legislature to give them what they want, if the governor doesn't like it, they figure the governor will blue pencil it. And so it means a line item veto. And so no matter what the governor wants, when it's a Republican governor, they hate the unions. When it's a Democratic governor, they're nicer to the unions. Whatever the governor wants, they give them. And the president's office goes up to Sacramento, and they sort of cut the best deal they think they can get out of the Department of Finance, and then they defend it in the legislature. And when we've gone up, Bob Meister, me, some others, and met with the legislature, and to talk about these issues and talk to them about all the problems that you see, they kind of look at you like you got off a spaceship from Mars. I don't know, because they say, well, OP tells us everything's fine. Because, you see, in fact, the fee increases you're talking about, except for this last one, were actually all programmed. And they are, in fact, predictable. Because when Schwarzenegger became governor, Schwarzenegger is moderate on a few issues. He's moderate on the environment. He's moderate on abortion. There's probably a couple of other things. But on fiscal issues, he is at the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. He is a big Milton Friedman free market ideologue. And when he came in, I was vice chair of budget that year, system-wide, and according to the vice president for budget at UC, Diana Ardwin, the governor's director of finance, said, we don't understand why the state is providing any money for higher education. If you get a college degree, you make more money, and so you should be willing to just pay for the college degree. We don't think it's a public good. And that is the philosophical position which has driven the Schwarzenegger administration. Now, what UC then did was they negotiated something with the governor called the Compact on Higher Education. This is not a fantasy of like left-wing paranoids. It's on the web. It's a public document. If you can go onto the UCOP website and read it. And the university had had these compacts, these deals with governors going back a very long time to try to make things predictable. And the 10% annual fee increases are written into the compact, along with language saying they could be bigger than that if necessary. It doesn't quite word it that way. It says that the fees will be increased at the rate of income growth in California, which is about 8 to 10%. Now you say, well, I'm not making 10% more money. My friends aren't making 10% more money. But as you heard before, the average includes all those like really rich people. And if you are a multimillionaire and you increase your income by 20%, that drags the average up. So while the median income in California has been stagnant or declining, the middle point, the average has been increasing at 8 to 10% a year. And so the university is committed to raise fees, also Cal State, at least the rate of average income growth. The other thing, though, and the even more radical thing in the compact, and this was something that had never been done before, is the university committed itself to seeking private sources to pay its core operating expenses. And that's something that had never been done before. UC had sought private money, but it was always to build buildings, to have some extra money for research, scholarship. And Bob Dines, our thankfully former president, had this fantasy that UC could be funded by partnerships with business, by gifts, by philanthropy. And the problem is there's two problems with that. The first problem is that there's just not enough money like that out there. In the compact, Bob Dines agreed to about a $1.5 or $2 billion cut in the university's core budget. Now, you often hear UC has a $20 billion budget, and you know, a $1 or $2 billion is 5 to 10%. It doesn't sound like that much. But that $18 to $20 billion includes all the parking garages, it includes the dorms, it includes the national labs, it includes the service operations of the hospital, and if you get rid of all the sponsored projects, and if you get rid of all of that stuff, and just look at the what we would call the academic core budget, that is what it actually takes to run what most people think of the university, the teaching and kind of core unsponsored research, that was about $5 billion a year. It's down to about $3 billion now. And so Dines gave away 20% of the core budget. And the problem is when you go out and you talk about philanthropy, people don't give money to pay to mow the lawn or to teach freshman English or to keep the library open. You know, things like they give money for some, like I run the tobacco center. We got a big foundation gift for tobacco research. I love it. It's wonderful. But it's funding a specific project. And the same is true of research, and the same is true with partnerships with business. Those gifts or those grants bring obligations with them, and the money doesn't go to pay the core expenses. So the compact really put the university on a catastrophic financial path based on a lot of wishful thinking in the part of the Office of the President, and then we had the economic downturn, which made it even worse. Now, I'd just like to show a little bit of data, because data is, you know, we are here at a place where data is supposed to matter. And I actually have been pretty not criticized Udoff because he is much smarter than Dines. Of course, that's not saying a whole lot, but, you know, he is, I think, much better than Bob Dines was because he's, like, not stupid. But you know, this is a great example of OP defending the governor. This was an interview in the New York Times last September, and Udoff was asked, told, UC is facing a budget shortfall of at least $753 million, largely because of cuts in state financing. Do you blame the governor? Now, if they had asked me that question, if the regents somehow wanted to make me the president of the university, unlikely, I would have said, yes, you're damn right. You know, he made this mess. But Udo said, I do not. This is a long-term secular trend across the entire country. Higher education is being squeezed out. It's systemic. We have an aging population, and we have a lot of concern about health care. So, this led us to actually look up what the actual data are. You know, kind of in science, you're supposed to do that. So here's the data. So this is educational appropriations for student FTE. Full-time student for public higher education in of inflation-adjusted dollars, and you can see that there has been a sort of downward trend. When Duke Majan, who's a Republican, it went down. Pete Wilson tried to build it up till he destroyed. Or no, Wilson had actually recovered a bit near the end. Gray Davis was doing okay till he decided that he completely destroyed the California economy. But you can see Schwarzenegger; it's just crashed. And if you look at higher ed in general. And this includes all the community colleges, too. So that's one reason it's lower. You can see that UC was doing a lot better than the rest of the country. And what Schwarzenegger has done is pretty much brought us down to the national average. So, in fact, the cuts that Schwarzenegger have made have been not just following the national trend. If they were following the national trend, we would be up here somewhere. Now, why can't I get this to advance? Okay. And then if you look at tuition, well, we have data going back a little further, and you can see the general pattern is Republicans like to push tuition up, and Democrats like to push it down. You know, the Republicans are red. And then you can see what's happened under Schwarzenegger. And the green line is the national trend. So you can see that UC actually has more or less, except for Pete Wilson's era, you know, was more, even under Reagan, was kind of following the national trend. But under Schwarzenegger, it's really, really, really taken off. So the statement that President Udoff made is just wrong. So, you know, I think that we have seen a change. You know, the governor just put his new budget out, and he actually didn't cut UC and CSU as much. You know, he cut everything else, but he didn't do this big cut at UC and CSU. He sort of held things, you know, more or less constant. There's a little bit of an increase, but when you take out enrollment growth and inflation, it's sort of flat. And I viewed that actually as a big victory because what I've learned in years and years and years of social activism is when you put huge amounts of pressure on powerful evil interests, the first thing they do is pretend to do something. And so the governor has gone from a kind of screw you mentality to I'm going to pretend to fix things. And the other thing which got a huge amount of good press and which OP praised is this constitutional amendment the governor has proposed. Where, you know, we have this horrible situation in California where the prisons now get more money than higher ed. And what the governor proposed doing was limiting prisons to 7% of the state budget, which is what they were a while ago, and guarantee UC and CA 10%, which is where they were a while ago. And if that happened, we would all be in quite good shape. But you know, and that sounds real good, but there are a few hooks. One is that the governor could simply declare a fiscal emergency and suspend the constitutional amendment. Okay, well, Governor Schwarzenegger has declared a fiscal emergency every year that he's been governor. Or the legislature could override the amendment by a two-thirds vote, which, until George Lakoff succeeds with his initiative, is exactly the vote which is required to pass the budget. So this amendment means nothing. It changes nothing. And but the other thing it is he ties it plan to privatize the prisons and give more money to his, you know, business supporters. And the amendment contains some very odd language. It contains something called the non-severability clause. Now, what does that mean? Normally, when you write a law that is complicated and has a lot of provisions in it, the legislature includes something called a severability clause. And what a severability clause says is if any part of this law is declared unconstitutional, the rest of the law remains in force. Okay, that just was very relevant in a lawsuit that tobacco companies brought against the new FDA law, where a court held that two provisions of the law were illegal, but upheld the rest of it. Well, the governor's initiative has a non-severability clause. So if you're not for his prison reform, then the universities don't get their money. Okay, so he's basically making higher education hostage to privatizing prisons. But the most appalling thing, and something not one reporter picked up on, is that you don't need this. The governor writes the budget. The budget then goes to the legislature and they tinker with it. But if the governor really wanted to limit prisons to 7% and give 10% of the state budget to higher ed, he could have just done it. You know, he doesn't need an initiative. He doesn't need a constitutional amendment. He could have just done it. And guess what? He didn't. Now, he did better than last year, and I think that's because of all the fuss which has been raised by everybody, and I think we need to keep raising a fuss. Now, the last thing that I want to do is, you know, one question, you hear this stuff about California has this huge budget crisis. And we can't afford it, and blah, 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 blah. Well, some of you may know I teach statistics here, and I like numbers. And so I asked the question, what would it cost to press the reset button on higher ed in California? And what I mean by that is to roll the fees back to where they were 2000, adjusted for inflation, which would roll them back from $12,000 to about $4,000 for the undergraduates, and huge rollbacks for the professional students. Return the state funding per student to where it was in the year 2000. Open the door to all the students that have been locked out, which is about 2,300 here, 40,000 at Cal State, 186,000 full-time equivalents at the community colleges. So if you put all of that into a spreadsheet and do the arithmetic, that would cost $4.6 billion. Okay? Now that sounds like a lot of money. Okay? But if we then amortize that out over all the taxpayers in California and did it with an income tax surcharge, how much do you think it would cost the median California income tax return? Which, if it's a joint return, it's two people. If it's if you're filing a single return, it's one person. So who wants to guess? $10. How much? What do other people think? We're going to raise $4.6 billion. We've had one person who has nerve. Anybody else want to guess? Yeah? $2.99. Anybody else want to guess? It's $32. Okay. So we have this wonderful system that was built up over many, many years, a public system that does all the things you just heard about, that creates wonderful, has created wonderful opportunities for people around the state, which I think the remaining two speakers are going to talk about, which has been the engine for improving the lot of people in California and the economy, which I would say second. The first thing is it's really improved people's lives, and the whole thing could be fixed for $32 to the median taxpayer. Two-thirds of the taxpayers would pay less than $86. You know, and when I've gone to people and some of my political friends and said $32, it's like, why are they taking the system and running it into the ground? Because Arnold just doesn't want to raise taxes on anything. $32. So that's my talk. So now I don't know how to get the other slides up. Oh, here we go.
Thank you, Stan. Next speaker is Robert Meister from UC Santa Cruz, who's going to talk about who pays and who benefits. Higher education and taxation as engines of equality and growth.
Thanks, Warren. So, Stan's reset button is a striking illustration of how to conceptualize UC as once again a public university, something that we have been encouraged to think is now unthinkable. What I want to do in my part of this is to give you three additional ways of thinking this thought, building on what Stan has said so far and leading toward the kind of statewide political movement that I hope and expect George Lakoff will discuss for us. First, I simply want to generalize and make a little bit more dynamic Stan's idea of the reset button as such. Once Stan chose his baseline year, 2000-2001, happens to be 10 years ago, that year becomes an arbitrary endpoint on a continuing engine for recalculating how much tuition would have to be rolled back in return for how much state funding might be restored. In other words, what Stan has really accomplished for us all is to produce a spreadsheet for calculating what tuition should have been done, have become, if UC had been serious about maintaining budgetary quality, which it wasn't, and how much tuition should be rolled back if UC is serious about restoring state support, which it isn't. In other words, with Stan's engine, thinking politically, thinking tactically, those of us who are engaged in this system-wide movement can actually formulate demands.
She's just ignore me.
Ignore her.
I'm ignoring her. We can actually formulate demands for how much both UC and the state, hard to ignore, how much both UC, how much both UC and the state should be required to change course in order for Stan's reset button to be set. Mark Udoff is using the word reset, but he applies it only to the state. We want to be a joint oppositional movement opposing the course that the state is on and also the course that UC is on, and demanding in return for restored state funding what Stan might have called a kind of counter-compact that UC would agree to, namely to roll back tuition increases, to put instruction first by reversing the instructional cuts that were made after state budget cuts, to be fully transparent about the use of all funds, not just state funds, and to stop rewarding executives as though UC were already a successful business. It is neither a business nor successful. I don't see why the CSUs and the UC and the community colleges wouldn't insist that UC reverse its policies if a master plan restoration occurs that funds UC at twice as much per student and gives UC half of all the total funds it would raise. If UC refuses this condition as a quid pro quo, we've got our political issue. We can demand that the legislature fund UC so as to make UC reverse course. Now I want to propose a second way of building on the work Stan has done, of thinking of UC as still public, by building out a little further on his analysis, at least metaphorically. One of the things he shows, although he didn't mention it today, is that $2.1 billion would be required to restore UC to its budgetary quality of 10 years ago, which would otherwise require a tuition increase of $7,000 per year more than it is now, but could be accomplished with a tuition increase that would roll it back to $7,000 less than it is now. I love these numbers. It's like the kind of hypothetical that I would think up as a political theorist, and Stan happens to have arrived at them. Now, one way of thinking about that is to simply say, let's financialize it. If this were a 5% return on an endowment, like Harvard has, what would that endowment have to be? Turns out to be $42 billion. In other words, the state could simply borrow general obligation bonds in the amount of $42 billion, paying around 3.5% interest rate, and let UC invest that money as essentially the financialized or endowment social capital version of what the master plan used to give us as recently as 10 years ago. And then, of course, you could say, well, UC could then have 5% return, if that's what universities get on their endowment. The state would only pay 3.5% interest. We'd be free of political volatility risk. And you could also say, well, let's look at the other $2.6 billion that we still get from the state. If you financialize that, it comes to $51 billion in endowment. So for $93 billion in total, we could have the social capital or endowment version of UC's master plan. This is what it would cost, in other words, to buy out the state's financial obligation and still leave UC as a public trust. Now, just stating this number shows what a gem UC has been for California and what a good deal it's been to do this with pay-as-you-go taxation rather than issuing state bonds. But as a thought experiment and as a way of stating what our demands would be, let's think about UC as though it were a state-endowed public university rather than a taxpayer-funded public university. Let's think of it as bond-financed rather than taxpayer-financed. Does this mean once UC actually had its public support in the form of an endowment, it could do whatever the hell it wants, which is what it does now with the money? Absolutely not. Such an actual endowment would have to be invested and distributed as a public trust. So if the state decided to keep the California's promise through bond financing rather than tax financing, UC would be subject to all of the restrictions as an administrator of the trust that it is now trying to avoid by privatizing. And these are the very restrictions that UC demands, or that CUCFA demands that UC accept today, rolling back tuition increases, restoring educational cuts, no use of public endowment funds to subsidize and leverage private partnerships, rolling back compensation to an appropriate public sector level, and full transparency about the use of all monies, including the give back of enrollment-generated monies, ed fees, and tuitions to the state. Most reporters haven't even picked up on the idea that there's more inequality in per-student funding within the UC system, for example, between Riverside and Davis, than there is between UC and CSU. You couldn't keep this quiet if UC's tax-funded endowment were actually administered as a public trust. And no one is actually looking at the fact that in order to fund the Blue and Gold program, which every reporter seems to simply parrot as though it's a done deal, UC would have to raise an additional $3 billion in endowment over and above its present $5 billion, a 60% increase at a time when the endowment is falling in value and the per student endowment is falling faster as enrollments rise. Now, suppose UC doesn't accept this form of accountability, then again, we've got our issue. We want more funding, and we want the state to give UC more funding in order to make it more accountable. And now I want to move on to a third and final interpretation of what Stan has done. Beyond hypothetical models, in order to really take seriously Warren's invitation to provide what he called in his flyer a progressive alternative analysis of UC privatization. Question is, why should UC be funded by all taxpayers in California rather than by those who attend, and particularly by squeezing eligible students to pay higher tuition and or take on greater debt? And to answer this question, we really need to combine the matter of price with the matter of principle. What price can you charge for higher education? Well, that's really how much California's affluent families are willing to pay to reproduce for their children their present class positions. Why should they pay less than they're willing to pay? And as income inequalities increase, why wouldn't they be willing to pay more to protect their children? That's really what the price of higher education depends on as an instrument of class reproduction for the affluent. But then there's the question of principle that would distinguish a public from a private university. Namely, does a public university provide something more than class reproduction? Does it provide at least class mobility? And does it work in the direction of narrowing rather than widening gaps in class position by promoting greater equality across society because of its impact and because of the way in which it's financed? Now, from this perspective, taking Stan's data very seriously, the striking fact is that the average cost of restoring public education would be $3,700 per taxpayer, and that the median cost would only be $32. In other words, the average cost, if you divided it equally among all taxpayers, is 100 times, over 100 times the median cost. There's a political analysis to be found here behind Stan's result, which I think is important for those of us who are interested in building on that result for a spring movement. Stan's result reflects the fact that in the last tax year available to him, 3/4 of all income taxes were paid by the top 20% of all taxpayers, and almost 1/3 of all income taxes in that year, maybe an unusual year, was paid by the top 1% of all taxpayers. That's why the person in the 50th percentile pays only $32. In other words, income inequality has gone through the roof since the tax revolt of Proposition 13, and this trend has actually accelerated, whether there's a causal connection or not, during the 10 years in which UC has pursued accelerated privatization. So to the 10 years culminating in Stan's analysis, the top 1% of adjusted gross income rose by 117%. In other words, the top 1% now starts at a minimum income of $500,000, but it goes up so rapidly from there that the average is $1.8 million, in other words, 50 times the wealth of the 50th percentile of all Californians. A decade ago, it was only 25 times the wealth of the 50th percentile of all Californians. In other words, these people in the top one percentile have pulled very rapidly away from the top 20% of the California population that might have otherwise, in a more equal economic distribution, been willing to incur debt to be in the top 20%. Only 1% can be in the top 1%. I think that's empirically true. In other words, one of the interesting coincidences in Stan's data is that less than the top 1%, 0.5% of all taxpayers, would actually have their taxes increased by the $8,000 that his proposal would decrease tuition by for everyone else. And one interesting thing, if you connect this to the state economic data, is that if income distributions had simply remained as unequal as they were 10 years ago, 99% of all Californians would already be $8,000 richer just by distributing from the top 1%. So if the top half percent begins to pay $8,000 more, well, again, as a political theorist, I couldn't have come up with a better hypothetical than Stan's numbers show. It's just nice numbers, Stan, good coincidence. Seems like we're at a tipping point if only people listen to my friend Stan, so let's get it out there. Well, I just want to say, not without a little further analysis, which strengthens the argument Stan's making. Polls such as PIPIC show two things about public attitudes toward higher education. One is that people aren't willing to pay higher taxes to support higher education. And two, they think the rich should pay a sliding scale, namely everyone should pay as tuition a fixed proportion of their income. Now, how can we interpret this? Well, I think these responses are consistent with a sense of the majority of respondents feeling left behind by an awareness of growing economic inequality. People now believe, partly from the media, partly based on UC's own propaganda, that higher education is a driver of economic inequality. And so the more economic inequality there is, the more people should be willing to pay or borrow to be on the right side, the upside of that, and the less taxpayers who are on the wrong side of that should be willing to pay in taxes to subsidize those who are going to be benefiting from it if they aren't. What people don't know, what they aren't being told, what needs to be added to Stan's analysis is just how rich the rich have been getting and how much richer the rich have been getting relative to everyone else in the past 10 years. A 40% tuition based on adjusted gross income would be, for the average person in the top 1%, $1 million to attend UC. Of course, that's even better than progressive taxation, isn't it? Why wouldn't you be in favor of that? But of course, for the rich, an upfront tuition of $40,000 or $50,000 is simply a cap on the cost of social reproduction and not a fair share. Now, what about everyone else? Well, for everyone else, tuition increases and the willingness to pay them is simply understood as increased eligibility for personal debt. What we give everyone along with college admission is an ability to borrow about $100,000 more than they would be qualified for based on income and assets. In other words, we put them in debt. I study this stuff. I'm head of the Rethinking Capitalism program at UC Santa Cruz. And I know that for 20 years, ever since deregulation, ever since the end of the Cold War, people around the world have been encouraged to think that borrowing more is a form of personal enrichment. This means they don't ask for redistributive taxation, they don't demand revolution. They simply are allowed to borrow against their hovel and incur personal debt in a way that gives them money in their pocket but keeps them down and down and down unless they happen to hit the jackpot with that money. It's global financialization that makes this kind of credit available because you can diversify away the risk of lending to any single high-risk borrower and thus impoverish more of the world by giving more of the world access to credit in order to allow them to take a chance that maybe they will get out of debt. Now, student debt, the model of debt financing here is really simply an extension of this theory to another subprime market. It's financialized in the sense that the lender puts all directional risk on whether the economy goes up or down on the student and simply takes volatility risk, simply takes a risk that it won't go up or down too much. It's federally guaranteed, which essentially subsidizes the lenders with a free credit default swap with the Treasury. And unlike all other debt, it survives bankruptcy, which means that the longer you never get out from under it and the longer it takes you to pay it, the more in interest on interest the lender makes. So UC's whole financial plan for the past 20 years has been based on the idea that people, if they're offered more opportunities to take debt, are more willing to take on debt because it gives them money up front than to address the economic inequality that UC is contributing to. Growing economic inequality increases your willingness to take on debt. Why? Because you're one of the top 12.5% of all students. You know that this increases your chance of being in the top 20% of all earners. What you don't know is that 20, 30, 40% of the earnings of the top 20% are now earned by the top 1%, and you have very little chance of getting there. You don't know that, so you're willing to take on more debt. I think we've got an issue here. I think the issue of debt financing versus taxpayer financing, who pays taxes, who incurs debt, is UC debt, in fact, part of a death spiral in which UC actually contributes to growing economic inequality, which makes it more and more necessary for students to take on more and more debt that they have less and less chance of paying off unless they make it into that 1%. Not to mention the fact that a third of all those who take on debt drop out without even getting their degrees. They just have the debt. Well, public education is in a death spiral where it's driving greater inequality, and the increase in inequality is a presupposition on which its financial plan is based. We have got to articulate this issue as a whole. We have got to break this cycle. Public education does not have to be a driver and parasite on social inequality. Public education has always in this state been a force for social equality. This is partly because of access. No barriers of debt hold down access. It's partly because of progressive taxation, and it's partly because of what a public university actually does when it's not beholden to private donors. In sum, in conclusion, the real question is how and why UC got away with shifting from being an equalizing force in society to being an engine of inequality, and how both inequality and UC's present course can be reversed simultaneously, first by reforming UC, and secondly by restoring the master plan. CUCFA, the organization that I'm in, that Stan is in, that Warren's in, may be the only group now that is raising these issues comprehensively. We'll be speaking to the Master Plan Commission. We'll be preparing a response to the Gould Commission. We're hiring a full-time organizer to coordinate with ad hoc groups throughout the state. And also, we're meeting, and I'm speaking, Stan is speaking, to insurgent faculty and student organizations at community colleges and CSUs. You should all be part of CUCFA if you aren't. And as president of CUCFA, I'm asking you to support Stan and Warren on your campus and help us articulate the argument. the argument for reforming UC by reversing its present course as a condition for restoring state funding in the master plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Last speaker, George Lakoff, professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley, author of California Democracy Act Ballot Initiative, and his topic is privatization and democracy, how we can change our future. George.
You can take it off.
Take it off.
Yeah. Take it off. That's all right. You don't need it.
Well, I want to show one thing later, but I'll just move it out of the way.
Okay, good.
There. I'm a techie.
All right. Let's move this back a little bit. Can you all hear me? Good. Hey. I want to begin with a footnote to Bob's talk, which is another little statistic. The top 1% of California citizens own more assets than the bottom 95%. Just take that one in. Right? That's, if you think in terms of assets, that's something worth thinking about. I mention it because there is a persistent view that there's no money in California, as the governor keeps saying. And there's plenty of money in California, as Bob was pointing out. So let's start there. Last spring, I was asked by Lonnie Hancock, my state senator, to go to Sacramento to talk to a group of Democratic state senators, about a dozen of them, and to see if I could help. And I walked into a room of very long faces. People I knew and had worked with looked terrible. So the first thing I did was say, what's wrong? What's the matter? You guys look awful. And the answer was, we have a majority in both the Senate and the Assembly, and we have no power. And the reason for that is that the two-thirds rules for raising, for passing both budget and raising any tax at all, limits us. We only have 63% of the legislature. That's not good enough to do anything. The remaining 37% of the legislators are ultra-conservatives. That is, they believe that government should not serve public needs, that it should be privatized, shrunk, gotten rid of as much as possible, get rid of public employees, public universities, etc. That's what they believe. And they have, you know, signed the Grover Norquist pledge, you know, not to raise any revenue at all in the state. Now, what this means is, first, gridlock in the budget, all budget processes. Second, it means that by saying no, they control everything. That is, if you're in the Democratic legislature, you of course need to get people paid. You need to get, you know, salaries paid, things done, etc. And the cost for that is blackmail. That is, the ultra right can say, "Well, we want more tax loopholes for corporations. We want you to fire a whole bunch of teachers, cut this budget, cut UC, cut CSU, etc." And the bargaining goes on until, you know, basically the right wing wins with 37%. And it occurred to me that this wasn't a good idea. That if you think about it, over the last 30 years, what's been going wrong in this state is largely that. And I've talked to people who've worked with the legislature and so on, and what they've said is that is the central problem right now. The problem. Now, thinking about this, it seemed to me that this was not quite democratic. You know, those people who, anybody who went through the third grade knows that the majority is supposed to win, but not in California. Now, it turns out that California is the only state in America that has this provision for both revenue and budget. It is the only anti-democratic legislature in America. This legislature has, since 1978, not known anything like democracy at all. No one serving there has ever served under democracy. Most people in the state don't know this. But minority rule runs the legislature. And that is the source of a huge number of our problems. Now, it occurred to me that since this was caused by the initiative process, initiative takes only a majority to pass, that it might be changed by the initiative process. So I looked into it. And it turns out that you can change it by changing two words in the Constitution. Two occurrences of the words two-thirds becomes a majority, and it's over. And that change can be described in one sentence. All legislative actions on revenue and budget must be determined by a majority vote. Does that sound strange or weird? No, it's what democracy would usually have and what happens in normal states. So I talked about this a bit over the summer to various groups, and I could not convince anybody to introduce a proposition to that effect. So on the last day, before there was no chance to introduce anything, I decided I would. And that's what I introduced, that proposition. At that point, certain interesting things happened. Namely, I had never done this before. I'm a professor. I'm not used to doing this. And then I found out the trouble I had gotten into. Right? First, it takes 1.3 million signatures to get it on the ballot. They have to be there by April 12th. Not too long. Second, you need to have a statewide organization to do that. You need to have fundraisers. You need to have signature gatherers. The signature gatherers have to follow all kinds of laws. The petitions have to meet God knows how many conditions. Okay? Lots and lots of stuff has to be done. But more than that, it seemed to me that this was an opportunity, not just the problem. That this was an opportunity to start a movement that needs to be started, not just in California, but throughout the country. So let me stop a minute and back off and talk about that for a minute. If you go to your favorite blog this morning, you may see a paper I've written on that, whether Huffington Post or Alternet or Truthout or whatever. In the past week, this country has had a triple whammy. The Supreme Court has decided that corporations are persons and that money is speech. And that is a disaster for this country unless the legislature can do something about that. So that's a question that, Barney Frank thinks that it's possible to rein in corporations through other laws and so on, and we'll find out. But right now, that is an absolute disaster. Citizens United is just a death panel for democracy. That's what the Supreme Roberts Court is. Now, in addition to that, we had the Massachusetts election, where the Tea Partiers basically got an ultra-conservative to become a senator in Massachusetts. That has completely shaken up politics in this country. And it has convinced the Obama administration that it can't do anything big because, of course, taking away the 60 votes to stop a filibuster means that you can't get any overall health care plan through the Senate, or through Congress in general. And apparently, the president is going to stop trying. He's going to go to incrementalism, trying to do a lot of little things instead. My prediction for the State of the Union address is you'll see a lot of incrementalist ideas, small things that it's hard to disagree with bit by bit, rather than large things that have to be done immediately. So what you're going to see is a disaster in all of these ways. Why is it there? It's there because there is no movement for democracy in this country. And by democracy, I want to characterize it in the way that I think is most accurately characterized. And I think Barack Obama's writings characterize it very well. Obama has written and said in speeches that democracy is based on empathy. That's based on citizens caring about each other. And when they seriously care about each other, they take responsibility for each other. They take social as well as personal responsibility. And they seek to make the world better by making their country better, by making their communities and families better, by making themselves better. That is what a democracy is about. And I think that's accurate. I think that is what American democracy has always been about. That has a consequence for governing and for governance. It says that a government has two moral missions, sacred moral missions, protection and empowerment. Protection is not just police or military protection. It is environmental protection, worker protection, consumer protection, investor protection, health care, Social Security, all of those forms of protection, protection of the food supply, and so on. And empowerment, which is something that conservatives never want to talk about, has to do with all the things that enable you to live a decent life and enable businesses to make money. It has to do with having roads and public buildings and a public infrastructure. It has to do with having a water system that works, an electric grid and communication system that works, an educational system above all that works, a banking system that allows businesses to get loans and people to get home loans at reasonable prices and so on. It has to do with having insurance that is sane and fairly priced and there. It has to do with having a court system that works for contracts. Without those things, without protection and empowerment by the government, no business makes a dime. That's it. You can't function. You can't live a reasonable life without those things. That is what taxation is really about. And when you make a lot of money, because the state provides all these things, you have a responsibility to pay your share back. That is what progressive taxation is about. Okay? Those ideas are something that are widely agreed upon in society, widely spread, certainly in this state, by most people, and they're never said, but we're going to say them. This campaign is not just about bringing democracy to the legislature in terms of majority vote. The campaign allows us to say the things that have been unsaid, starting there, and many others, like the simple figure that the top 1% has more property than the bottom 95%. Right? That's what this is about in the state. We're going to be not just gathering signatures, we're forming a speakers bureau to go through every electoral district. We want to get volunteers to speak and volunteers to assist them and book them, because the right wing already has speakers everywhere, on radio and TV and in every civic organization, and they are booked there by booking agencies, in case you didn't know that. So It's important that this be not just about this initiative, but that it be the beginning of a democracy movement. That democracy movement is, it should not just be about California, because the same issues are everywhere. That view of democracy and of government is what needs to be broadcast everywhere in this country and repeated all over. And it is the basis for what a democracy movement should be. When Obama came into power, he came into power after a remarkable campaign that was almost perfect. I mean, as a linguist looking at his language, he made only 5 mistakes in 20 months and corrected them in 2 days. I sent a little note. I didn't have to do anything, really. They were great. As soon as they took power, they reversed course. They decided that what was involved in governing was twisting arms and making deals and moving to the right when necessary and trying to be bipartisan. And what they didn't do was try to set up a movement, to build on the movement that was possibly there and to make a movement throughout the country and to build a communication system and a system of speakers that would be there all the time expressing those ideals. Because if you think about what's going on in Blue Dog districts and conservative districts, the people there only hear the right-wing views. You know, they're not going to hear anything else. And it's important that we have people all over the country hearing other views, hearing views about what democracy really is and should be. And we can start in California. So that's what this initiative is about. It's not just about the legislature, but remember that with respect to higher education, there will be no money for it unless this initiative passes. That is, you need to have this pass in order for the legislature to be able to give that money. Because right now, if you go on March 4th to Sacramento and you say, we need more money for UC, CSU, etc., what Democratic legislators who support you will say is, but wait a minute, we're being forced also to cut money for K-12, we're firing teachers everywhere, we're cutting money for health care, we're cutting money for battered women's shelters, for AIDS, for, you know, long lists of for housing, for all the things that very poor people need. And, you know, we're not sure that we can, you know, do much for UC. We're pitting UC and higher education versus other vital needs. That's because if there's no more money, that's what's going to happen, and that's what you'll hear. So simply going there without having the strong support for this ballot initiative is not going to do much, I'm sad to say. And that fits very well with what Bob was saying, that we need to be able to understand what income distribution is, and we need to understand it because this initiative is going to be attacked. And it's going to be attacked in the obvious way. They're going to say, that's going to raise taxes. Now, think about the term raise taxes from the point of view of a linguist. Sorry, I'm a linguist, that's what I do. When most people hear raise taxes, they hear three things. Raise my taxes. 2, raise tax rates. And 3, affect me significantly. Those are the three things they're going to hear. They may not be true for an interesting reason. First, you can get a lot of money and a lot of revenue by charging oil companies for the oil they take out of the ground right now. It's called the oil severance tax. Doesn't raise any tax rates or affect any individuals. Second, there are huge numbers of tax loopholes given to corporations. You can get rid of those loopholes and raise probably tens of millions of dollars. Billions of dollars, not millions. Billions of dollars. So a lot of money can be raised without raising any tax rates on any individuals. But then think of that 1% versus 95% again. If you're in the bottom 95%, that's a majority. And if you bring majority rule to the state, what does that say? It says people who have not had a voice in government, and this is important, most people don't know that they have no voice in government if they're voting for a majority, if they're part of a majority. If this passes, they will have a voice. The majority of people who are electing the majority of legislators right now are perfectly sensible people. People around the country think that Californians are nuts, that they, you know, don't, that they're financially irresponsible. They think that the legislature is financially irresponsible. Well, over 60% of the legislature is perfectly responsible and sensible and smart. Over 60% of the people who send them to the legislature, of the voters, are perfectly sensible and responsible. If they are the majority. If the majority rules, we have the possibility of bringing perfectly sensible, responsible government back to the state. Now, the question then is, you know, if they're going to raise taxes, what taxes are they going to raise? Are they going to be on yachts and private planes? Right now, that's not a permissible thing to happen in the state. Are they going to raise tax rates? If they're going to, who are they going to raise them on? Should they be proportional to assets? Should they be proportional to income, etc.? Those are things where, if they are, most people's taxes won't go up. And that's the point, that it doesn't take a lot for the median taxpayer to make this state sane. That is a message that Bob is bringing out, that Stan is bringing out, and that needs to be said. That when you vote to get rid of the two-thirds rules and bring democracy back to the state, what you're doing is not saying we're going to raise everybody's taxes so they can't afford it. What you allow is the majority to say, we want fair taxation. We want economic democracy. That's what this is about. Now, that message needs to be out there very strongly, because this will be attacked as raising taxes. And it's a hard message to get out there. It's not so easy, but it can be done. But especially the message that you have had no voice needs to be changed. Now, one of the most important things, I want to say it very briefly, is that privatization in the state, the ideology of it, and corporatization, which goes with privatization, is being introduced in the university. That what happens in privatization is in privatization of the university is not just raising tuition to the level of private schools. It's much more. It has to do with bringing the notion of corporate life into the university. Now, what does that mean? In any corporation, there are two kinds of employees, the assets and the resources. The assets are the people who are hired by headhunters who, you know, get high salaries and bonuses and, good offices and so on. The resources are hired by human resources. That's why they're called human resources. And what does a corporation do with resources? It tries to minimize their cost. It tries to pay as little for resources as possible. Hence, the resources are the staff, the lecturers, you know, all sorts of people that the university thinks, if it's a corporation, they should minimize. Cut the janitors, cut the staff, cut the lecturers, you know, cut the number of GSIs, etc. Cut the resources, right? That is part of corporatization. Another part of corporatization is running according to corporate values in general, not in terms of public needs. of thinking as, let's say, UC Berkeley has been thinking. That is, they say, look, in order to keep up our quality and hire people appropriately and outfit labs for new professors and so on, we're going to have to cut the number of state students we take in from California, from the state, and bring in out-of-state students who pay much more. And if we bring in the right number of out-of-state students, then, you know, that will help a lot, and we just cut out, you know, a bunch of students from the state. And that will happen more and more as more and more funds get cut each year. Now, that is a disaster for our state. Cutting out the number of students who can go to this wonderful state university and cutting that quality of that university is remarkable because this university is a public good and every student in it is a public good and every professor is a public good. And students don't realize that. There's a wonderful sign at the first Berkeley protest. There was one student saying, I am a public good. I think every student should have that sign for the following reasons. If you go to UC or CSU and get a serious education, a superior education, you become, first of all, able to function better in any business you go into or any profession you go into. Many of those students, many of you, go into professions that serve the public. That means the public will be served better and by more people. If you go into private business, it means that private business will have higher quality, more creativity, you know, more productivity. And what that means is the economy will grow more. And in general, a dollar spent on higher education in this state produces $4 in the state's economy. I mean, this is good for the economy of the state as a whole, but it's good for health in the state, it's good for the environment in the state, it's good for everything else in the state, whether it has to do with the arts, with culture, with an appreciation of nature, or any of the things that are important in your life. The quality of life in this state depends crucially on higher education. And that is something that is generally not recognized and has to be said. And it has to be said out loud. In addition to that, there's something that people in UC have not said. And if they're going to Sacramento, it's time they said it. There's a reason why you have research universities, where research professors teach undergraduates. I always teach undergraduates. I teach both graduate students and undergraduates. The graduate students are the next generation of great researchers and great teachers. The undergraduates are the generation of the next great professionals coming through. Why? Because if I'm teaching Cognitive Science 101, the research I did this morning is going to be in that course within a couple of weeks. And I mean it. That's what I'm teaching to my sophomores and my juniors and my seniors. Namely, what is going on now? Not just knowledge that's going on now that is important, but how to think about it. How to think about how to advance knowledge. How to think about being creative. How to see what a problem is. That's what a research university teaches its undergraduates. And that's why it is absolutely crucial. So to preserve all that, we need activism. The activism that we've had on campus has been crucial. But we need positive activism. Activism that says, hey, get out those signatures. Get this ballot initiative approved and then get it passed. And one of the things that we're doing, we're trying to raise money for this, you know, to hire, we want to get a system of speakers and signature gatherers. And we also want to raise money if we fall short of get professional signature gatherers. But we're going to be able to use a new system of online signature gathering. That is, it turns out there are 11 million iPods and iPhones in this state. And with iPhones and iPods, there is a technology that's just been developed where you can sign online. And you can send the ability to do this to all your friends on Facebook and Twitter and on your lists. That is, signature gathering is, yes, physical signature gathering is important and builds a structure and an infrastructure, and it's crucial in all of this. But we will soon have online signature gathering, and it can go viral. That's why it is possible to do this by April 12th, when we need 1.3 million signatures. We will need small contributions and large ones if you can afford it, and we will need a lot of help. Thank you. Either have to borrow, which means they get a tax, they have to pay more, but they also have to borrow the money, have to pay the interest, which is usually 100%, and they have to pay that interest with after-tax earnings. So it's more like 130%. So basically, you are imposing extra taxes if you do that, or you're imposing a bigger tax of not being able to afford to go to college, which is a tax you pay all your life because you are earning less, not reaching your potential, et cetera.
Other questions?
In the back.
Sure, a lot. Okay. First, go to that website, sign up, and get all the documents and so on. And soon we'll be able to allow you to, go online and register and send all your friends and have them register and allow them to send these things to their friends. In addition to that, you have parents at home and neighbors. And they need to know this. You can sign them up. You can, when you go home, sign everybody up for this. Get as many signatures as you can at home. But tell your parents about this, because they need to do this as well. This is about your future. And if your parents care about your future and the future of your children, then this is a crucial thing that they have to do for this state. If they care about the state and love the state, they'll do this.
I could just add, there's really two campaigns going on here that are kind of interlinked. One is the initiative campaign that George is running, and the other is the Keep California's Promise campaign about higher education within that context. I have to say, I heard a joke yesterday that the Democrats were bragging that actually they won in Massachusetts because they got 46% of the votes. So, you know, I mean, it's crazy. But I think, you know, part of it is getting people to just think about these issues differently. And, you know, and that's why I really like what George is doing, too. You know, one of the things that just amazed me in the work I did at System-Wide on budget was just how, for all of the money those guys get paid over there, they don't know how to add and subtract. And, you know, that the money that they gave away in the compact with Schwarzenegger and an ideological shift that the university accepted. And it, as Bob said, it had been brewing for a long time. But the compact really represented a sea change in public policy in California that was debated by no one. It was three guys getting together in a room. The governor, the president of UC, and the chancellor of CSU. And they threw out 50 years of higher education policy in California. The legislature wasn't involved. The legislature hates the compact. The regents were told about it after the fact. They were mad, but they didn't do anything about it. And CSU, the Board of Trustees, the same thing. And people need to understand that three guys threw away a half a century of productive public policy in California and put us on a trajectory that just isn't going to work. I mean, it's a little bit like, again, for a few of you were around during the merger with Stanford. You know, which just didn't work. I mean, there were all kinds of philosophical reasons about public goods and all the things you've heard about, which those of us who spoke out against it brought up. But even if you threw out all of the liberal fuzzy thinking, the numbers just didn't add up either. And that's the problem that we have today. And in order to get the quality of UC back to where it was in 2000, measured as expenditures per student, which is a rough measure, we would have to increase the fees another $8,000. So we have a situation now where, as you know, as students, you're paying a lot more to get a lot less. And we're not even coming close to this image of privatization. The other thing that's very important is, you know, people look at Stanford and Harvard and say, well, if you're as good as Stanford and Harvard, why can't you do it? Well, Stanford has about 12,000 or 13,000 students now. When I went to Stanford in the early 70s, it had 10,000 students. During that same time, UC more than doubled in size. So it just doesn't, you know, the same kind of games you can play and rules you play by when you've got 10,000 students versus 300,000 students is just different. But I think that the best thing to do is to just do something, you know, because it is all the noise that the students made that have actually got the system moving now. We just now need to get it to where it needs to be.
I got to say something very specific in response to your question. There's George's initiative. There's the Keep the Promise thing that Kukva's been doing. Three of us, all of us, all four of us are on the same page. What do you think the governor had in mind when he said, we're going to have a ballot initiative that will, in a sense, reverse UC's reliance on private funding by privatizing the prisons instead? What he had in mind was killing the student movement that's going on now. It's the student movement that's going on now and that went on in the fall.
Can you move the microphone away a little bit?
Oh, sorry. It's the student movement that's going on now. I like to hear the reverb. It's the student movement that was going on now and particularly what happened after the November movement, Regents meeting, that changed everything. The whole point of Schwarzenegger's strategy is, and Udall's strategy, is that we're all in this together for the short run, and the long-term issue is going to be on the ballot next November. We have got to keep this moving, and we've got to keep this moving by making it clear that we're not on the same page with Udall and the Regents, and that we want more money, and that this is an oppositional movement that isn't going to die, and that isn't going to die this winter, and that is going to press the issues that we've been talking about here. And I agree entirely with what George Lakoff said about the two-thirds rule. The kinds of issues that we're raising, however, really ought to get the support of 99% of the population. So we could afford to lose a lot and still satisfy the two-thirds rule.
Question.
Would you mind if
John.
I spoke really quickly?
Just no, let's have a question.
Can I answer her question?
Okay.
Thank you.
Ask if you have your website on the board.
Oh, it keeps going out.
Oh, yeah, that's so to answer your question in specific, there is a group of students actually that is elected by students here and then represents students as a whole on the state, and it's the UC Student Association. And actually, independent of signature collection for ballot initiatives, which actually needs to be done well in advance of this, they have a lobby conference which educates students on grassroots organizing and lobbying that occurs actually the very last weekend in February, and then go on to lobby the legislature, as ineffectual as some of the speakers here may think it is, on the 1st of March. So if you're interested in attending that, you should talk to me as a representative of you here at UCSF. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Other questions? Back.
I have a question for the student representative. And since it seems like the student action in Los Angeles against the Regents meeting is really very effective, no matter what you care about, whether the Regents are responsible or not, I think just the press they garnered is excellent. Will the student movement continue that action with future Regent meetings?
The answer is yes, that they will. It's actually quite difficult to mobilize students, and it's great to see students so impassioned. They usually have actions at many Regents meetings and at least one or two a year. And it's great to see that this year there was so much press and support. Normally you don't know that it's occurring because there aren't as many students able to cut class to go to a Regents meeting. And so we're very limited in how much the simple numbers that we can generate, let alone statewide numbers, since we're all over the state of California. The last thing I'll say is that it occurs at every meeting, and if you specifically look at especially campus university papers, that's where we tend to get our media attention, and obviously getting more media attention from bigger national statewide media really helped to get the message out to everyone in California that students aren't happy about this. It's a message that really needs to be heard by the entire state. Most people in their living rooms have no idea how pissed off the students and faculty are about the changes of the UC. It's probably the issue at heart here that's going to be important to get any initiative passed, to get any change in legislature or government, governor policy, is simply changing the mindset of people sitting in their living rooms at 7 o'clock at night watching television. They never know what's happening in the UC system.
Another question.
I just want to add one thing. Now, I'm not against talking to the legislature, or the regents, but I think you have to understand the real problem is the governor. And it's the governor's budget, it's the governor's line item veto, it's the governor's baloney constitutional amendment, and it's not just this governor, it's the next governor. Because what have we heard out of any of the candidates on this? And you know, my theory is I would like Schwarzenegger to be the bozo clown, so that Jerry Brown, or if we get a decent Democratic candidate, and whoever the Republicans put up, know that they have to deal with this problem. Because as long as they can put it off onto the regents or put it off onto the legislature, they'll put it off. And so I think, you know, it really, this issue has to be injected into the gubernatorial campaign. And the message I would take to the regents, by the way, is don't raise our fees, and they'll just say, we don't have any money. I think the message to the regents is to say, you are a failure. You, as the trustees of this public good, have not defended it. You are not doing your job. And I can tell you, I got to know a few of them when I was chairing budget, and these guys think of themselves as like hot stuff. And I think going to them and publicly shaming them as the failures that they are, as their failure to act as stewards of this great institution, will really get under their skin. You know? Because yelling at them and telling them they shouldn't raise their fees, your fees, or cut the employees, they'll just say, well, you don't understand. We're business people. We understand. We don't like it. We have no choice. But, you know, when is the last time you've seen the Regents stand up with a full-throated defense of the idea of public higher education? Or give the kind of speech you gave? I've never seen it. And I mean, one thing you ought to do, if you go to the Keep California's Promise website, there's a lecture. Bob and I spoke at UCSB, and a history professor there named Norm Lichtenstein gave a wonderful little speech about Clark Kerr, the guy who came up, former president of UC, the guy who came up with the master plan, and talked about how Kerr was actually against philanthropy to pay for higher education because it undermined the public mission. And you just listen, he was reading sections, we got it from him and put it on the website. I mean, we need, you know, another thing for students to do is go to the leadership and say, why aren't you giving speeches like Clark Kerr gave? You know, and to the Regents, why aren't you giving speeches like Clark Kerr gave? Why is it being left to the students, to the staff, and to the faculty to do the job of defending the institution that its leaders should be doing?
Yeah.
Question for you, which is, what is there a unified message yet across the unions and the students and the faculty?
This is what this is about right now, which is going on, is part of this committee, and there are committees all over the state, in Los Angeles, Santa Cruz, everywhere else, and part of what these committees are doing is reaching out to labor unions, because working class people are the ones who are going to be hurt the most by this, because their kids are not going to be able to afford to go to universities, and they're the ones who are having, you know, unions are being attacked, they're having their pay cuts, so transport workers are going to be coming out, they're going to be striking, teachers are going to be striking. So this is about us all coming together to find out what our common goals are. But one of them, which obviously everyone talked about today, is we all agree that public education is a good thing and we want to stop the attack. I think workers, teachers, and students, we would all agree on that one as a starting point.
Well, but one serious question was raised in Nanette Asimov's recent piece in the Chronicle about the Regents and Udoff wanting to march with the students and co-opt, in effect, the student movement. There seemed to be some support for that by the leader of the SUA, and I think you need to think seriously about the position that was taken by Callie Madoff, who was the one of the leaders of the Berkeley strike, in distancing ourselves. Fortunately, Udoff and the Regents have made it easier for us by wanting nothing to do with our movement. They're going to have their own march, but it would have been awkward otherwise, and I think we really need to keep our independence and our criticism of them alive, along with our support for public higher education financially.
Other questions? Yeah.
I think my concern is not just higher education, but
louder.
I think it's really stupid that. Oh, I think it's really stupid that I'm kind of dumb. I don't know what a mayor does. I've been through this college. I've been through the high school system, college system, and there's no civic classes. Not very many people that I know really can honestly participate in this democracy, what democracy we're about. And it's just regardless of how we get, like, how much we fund, like, higher education, we're going to, especially now that there's going to be a backlash, like, to the lower, like, K through 12, more and more people are going to come to higher education completely unprepared. And it's going to reverberate, it's going to be terrible, and then we're going to have more citizens who cannot vote with the educated, like idea of what they ought to vote.
Look, you're absolutely right. And, you know, what Prop 13 did was cut out education. But in addition to that, we had, during the Clinton administration, UCLA set up a national board of historians to have a national history curriculum that really told the accurate history of America. The conservatives in Congress cut all the funding for that, so that, you know, it's still there, but, you know, hasn't been used at all. This is why it's so important to have people being able to speak out in a coordinated way everywhere. Because unless people have an understanding of that they don't have democracy and all the places that democracy matters, which is in everything, they're not going to have any understanding of it. It is possible to have speakers who are able to do that, who can be booked on radio and TV in a regular way, etc., and who can go into classrooms and talk about it. But meanwhile, unless we have money for all of these things, which is what is required in this ballot initiative, there's not going to be money for any of it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
How do you feel about amending Proposition 13 so that corporate tax property, corporate property is not included in the bill anymore? Do you feel that's a great idea or not? Because it's kind of a split roll.
The term split roll, no one understands. But there's actually an easy way to do this if this ballot initiative passes. And the reason is this. What Prop 13 says is that property gets reassessed when it is sold and when there's an ownership transfer. The question is, what counts as an ownership transfer for a corporation? That is, do you define a change of ownership if, say, 5% of the stock changes hands, or some percentage of stock changes hands, right? If you did that, then you would get the reassessment and get rid of this problem without overturning Prop 13, simply by having a legislative redefinition. So again, if you get rid of the two-thirds rules, you can have that and get rid of that and change it and get $5 billion a year more, you know, in just that way. So it's very important to see that this single change, bringing democracy to the legislature, is crucially important. Yes?
Why does it require 1.3 million signatures?
Because it requires technically about 670,000, but they throw out a certain number.
Okay.
And the way they do it is by sampling. They go through and they take certain samples, and they, you know, and then they say, how many of these do we throw out? And if the proportion is too high, then they cancel the whole thing. That's why it's 1.3 million. So, for example, if you know, if the margins are, you know, an eighth of an inch off.
Go ahead.
I actually have two questions, and one of them, it might be better if I ask you after the panel, but I was just wondering, in terms of keeping the push for a better funding, public funding for higher education, to be disconnecting that from K-12 education to such an extent.
Talking about higher education and not K-12. Well, because up until now, there has been no coordination or collaboration among the different elements of higher education. And I can tell you, while I agree with what the gentleman in the back said about getting everybody on the same page, I've been trying to do that for 4 years. And, you know, one of the ways that the politicians have wrecked higher ed is by getting UC, CSU, and the community colleges fighting with each other over a shrinking pie. And so we came up with the idea of like trying to defend the whole system as a whole. And you would think that would be like easy, but I'm telling you, it's not. I mean, we've been working with some of the unions on trying to get exactly the kind of common statement that you were talking about, which is basically to restore funding, access, and accountability. And getting back to some of the things that Bob was talking about. And you would think it would be easy to get everybody to agree. And we got a bunch of people in a room from representing various interests and agreed on a fairly clear statement. And that was a month and a half ago, and it's still. And so while I'm completely in agreement that we need to save the whole system, you know, the higher ed system was at least something, you know, that it looked like we might be able to do. Plus, frankly, it's a lot cheaper. You know, it would cost more money to fix K-12. That's not to say we shouldn't do it. I mean, I know there have been a movement to bring all of public education together, and I totally, totally, totally support that. But within that, you know, K-12, if you look historically going back the last 20 or 30 years, K-12, as bad as the situation is, and it's horrible, has done way better than higher ed. And the reason for that is they've got the California Teachers Association who's willing to go out there and scare politicians. And for higher ed, we just haven't had that. You know, the administrations have basically and Cal State is no different, have operated in suck up to the governor. The unions have all been squabbling with each other. And the faculty have not been very well organized. And that's what we're trying to overcome. And, you know, the fact that this whole thing started a couple of years ago when the political director for AFSCME said to me, and this was a very controversial view inside of AFSCME, and it still is controversial, although less so. I figured out that if we don't have a decently funded higher education system, we can negotiate and strike till the cows come home, but if there's no money there to negotiate for and to pay our employees and to have enough janitors and all that, we can't. And we have to start working together with the faculty, with the students. That was a radical view 3 years ago. And he's moved to Texas because his wife got a job, and he's a surgeon, and he followed his wife. But, you know, that's why the Keep California's Promise thing is talking about higher ed. But, you know, I'm totally in agreement with the idea that we've got to reassert not just public education, if you talk about what George said, the whole idea of public goods, because those have been just getting trashed for years and years and years. And I don't hear anything coming out of any of the major Democratic leaders in California defending the idea that we need a public sector, even.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to end this now. Thank you for your patience. I'd like to thank the speakers. If you have further questions for them, I'm sure they'll answer outside.
See you.